Nat e Kevin Yunche. What it eat in Schle? What's on the bushes chain? Dig it ego a sun in a Schle. Good afternoon, everyone, or good evening, everyone. My name is Kevin, and I am an adult child. From alcoholic home and dysfunctional family, and also an recovering alcoholic and recovering from compulsive eating addiction and some other things. thank you, Greater East Bay ACA, for all your beautiful work. I've listened to some of the speakers and they're just amazing, amazing, amazing talks. And also, for all the hard work of the service people and I see my Turtle Island ACA family here and some other friends here. Thank you for your support and thank you for the honor and the trust, to ask me to share my experience, strength and hope at this time. So I can speak to what time? It is 4:05 PM.
Till 4:40.
4:40.
Do you want a warning, like a 5-minute warning, or are you okay?
A warning would be good, loud and clear, please.
Okay, we can do that.
Indeed.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so I introduced myself in my first language is Diné, that's Navajo. I said I come from Bitter Water people and Big Water people. And this is the kind of woman that I am. That's how we introduce ourselves. Where I come from, we have clans. And the clans were created by, Asanatlehe, that's the changing woman, the mother of the people. She created four clans from her body originally. And mine, Twitichini, is one of them. And my grandmother used to tell me that Sanatlehe, changing woman, created this clan from her body. She says, from under her arm, behind her heart, next to her bosom. This clan comes from there, my clan, Heart Clan. So I'm very honored to not only come from this people and this clan, but to speak today in this way. It feels like an honor to share experience, strength, and hope. I was born to an alcoholic mother, and I don't know. I never met my biological dad, but my mother was a young alcoholic woman. She was just beginning probably her career in alcoholism. When she became pregnant with me, I have no idea and I just have to say this up front, that my story has maybe a lot of trigger warning, has, sexual violence in it, has physical violence in it, has suicide in it. So I just want to say that it's not pretty. The experience is not pretty. And I don't sugarcoat it. I tell it like the way I remember and what I felt. So anyways, this young woman, this young, beautiful woman who was just starting on her way into, you know, the love of her life, which is booze. And she found out she's pregnant with me. And again, I don't know if, you know, I'm a product of rape or a one night stand or, and, you know, if it was a loving relationship, I don't know, because every time I asked my mother, she was drunk and she always told me a different story about the man who was my dad, the man who fathered me. So I don't know. So I feel like my story of abandonment, my story is of profound abandonment. I feel like it began in utero, you know, because mama, she already was feeling ambivalent about her pregnancy and about the fact that I was inside of her, and maybe I was an obstacle to her drinking, an impediment to her drinking. I was stopping her from going full-fledged and having her whatever time with alcohol, the love of her life. And in those days when she got pregnant, it was a shame to be pregnant without your husband, the dad of the baby. And so she went to my grandma's home in the reservation, and she basically like hid out over there, because later when I grew up, I asked my aunties and my cousins and my uncles about my mama's pregnancy. And they basically said, we didn't even know your mom was pregnant. We didn't even know she was going to have a baby until all of a sudden she had a baby. So it was like a secret. I was a secret. I don't know if it was a dirty secret or a happy secret, or, but a secret secret. And, but what I remember, is not really after I was born. I don't really remember my mama being around. Who I remember is my grandmother. She gave me, you know, to my grandma, and I got bonded to my grandma, this lady who didn't speak any English. She was not formally educated. She lived, you know, in the primitive way, the way our people did, you know, off the land with her sheep. And she was self-supporting through her own contributions, like we say in the other program, you know, because she used her sheep's wool. She used her sheep's meat. She fattened the lambs and took them to the market for money. She, you know, used the wool from the sheep to weave her rugs and sell them to the trader man. And that's how she got the groceries to feed feed me. And that's how I got raised up. And I love my grandma. She wasn't a perfect woman. She was an angry, bitter woman. You know, she's the only woman of all my maternal side that didn't ever drink alcohol. All her brothers and sisters, they somehow were affected by alcohol. They either drank themselves to death or something happened to them. This includes my mom, who died from alcoholism when she was 48 years old. And my little sister, who's just a couple years younger than me, died of alcoholism in 2017. And a bunch of, I say more than 50% of my maternal family died from alcoholism or some related to alcoholism. So alcoholism is like ran like a tornado through my bloodlines. And I look back and, you know, like I said, my grandma was the oldest of all her siblings, and lots of her brothers and sisters were affected by alcoholism, and my cousins, and just it was heavy duty. So, you know, when I was four, before I go to age four, so I love my grandma. That's the mama. She, to me, she was my mama. She raised me up in the, you know, in the traditional way that we do, you know, by learning how to go be with the sheep and herd the sheep and take care of the sheep and look after the sheep. That was the love of her life. She loved her sheep. If one of them went missing in the evening, she'd be looking at the flock and she says, the one with the patch on the ear and the crick in the neck and the, and she says, that's the one we have to go find. I'll be like, oh, grandma. So we have to go, you know, with our flashlights and go in the arroyos and, you know, and sure enough, the lamb would be laying under the bush, you know, and she'd say, I knew it. I knew it. And she picked, you know, we get the lamb and she says, see right here, his ear and his this and that and the patch. She was always right. So yeah, she loved her sheep and, you know, in our way, whenever our people were given sheep, you know, livestock permits and all that, that was their way of life. Whenever that started, to her, that was her livelihood. That was the way that she was going to save her children and save her family and support her family. So she put all her blood, sweat, and tears into this way of living. And she was the only one of all her siblings that all the way up until she died, she had her sheep, until she couldn't care for her sheep anymore. But yeah, so as a little girl, you know, I was too small to follow her, when she went to go herd the sheep, but she would separate, you know, the baby lambs from the mother ewes, and she would put the babies in a pen all by themselves, you know, because when you take the sheep out in the hot sun, the babies get separated from the mamas, and the babies, they, you know, go under a bush and go to sleep. And the mamas, they're just out grazing and they don't mean to leave their babies behind, but they, you know, they just tend to just go be feeding and they forget the babies and the babies will be left behind. So she always put the babies in the separate pen and she would take the mamas out. And I, as a little girl, got to be in charge of looking after the babies. And she would always tell me, you know, in our language, she would say to me, you know, don't touch the babies. Don't touch the babies too much because the mamas can smell you. And when the mamas smell the baby, they're going to smell you and babies are going to be rejected from their mamas. They're not going to want their babies, you know, in the evening when it was time to suckle the mamas. And I'd say, I promise, Grandma, I promise I will not touch the babies. And she'd take the sheep out, you know, up the hill, you know, towards the mesa. And as soon as I saw my grandma out of sight over the hill, I jumped over that fence, that pen. I crawled in the pen with the babies and I chased those babies around the pen and I picked them up and I squeezed them and I hugged them and I kissed them. That's probably the most joyous memory of my childhood, is loving on those babies. And yes, one of the few innocent, sweet memories of my childhood is the scent of those lanolin babies in my arms. And in the evening or in the mid-afternoon when she comes back and it's time for the mamas and the babies to meet up, sure enough, you know, like the babies would, they would try to go to their mama and their mama would kind of push them away with their heads. And she says, did you touch the babies? And I say, no, Grandma, I didn't touch the babies. She knew I touched the babies. But she asked me that every day, yeah? She'd always say, did you touch the babies? No, Grandma, I promise I didn't touch the babies. But she always had a way where she would take the babies and rub the babies on the mama's behind and re-scent the baby. And then the mama would retake the baby for suckling. But like I said, that was, that's a memory that's near and dear to my heart, like a joy memory. Then when I was 4 years old, I remember my mom coming around And she took me to boarding school. And my grandma didn't want me to go, but, you know, she told her mother, do you want me to go to jail? Because I'm going to go to jail if I don't take her to school. And she wouldn't, I don't think she would have gotten to, she, they've taken her to jail, but it was a true fact in the 1860s, 70s, 80s, when boarding school first started up, you know, Indigenous parents did get taken to jail when they hit their children from the authorities, from the American soldiers who came to get the babies, from the agents who came to gather the babies for boarding school. After some time, that law got loosened up. And I don't think that by the time that she was going to take me to boarding school, she would have gotten to jail. But, you know, like that is called colonization, that mindset of being colonized, right? That you still tend to believe and say those and carry those messages forward. And she tells my grandma, do you want me to go to jail if I don't take this baby to school? And so, you know, she took me to boarding school, and she took me to a Christian boarding school. I was raised up with the Christians. And so I was abandoned in utero. And then at four, to boarding school. And, you know, it was hard to articulate, you know, all the feelings around that, you know, because I was always waiting if my mama was going to remember to pick me up, waiting if somebody's going to come and pick me up, waiting if somebody, you know, I would see all the kids on a Friday and all the pickups coming and, you know, their grandmas, their uncles, their aunties, somebody's coming to pick them up or to bring them a treat or check them out, you know, to go into town for shopping. And I would sit, you know, and nobody ever came for me. Nobody, you know, until it was time to go home for, you know, like a week for Christmas break and then the 6 weeks for summer break. So I was literally raised up by these white Christians. And I always said that I felt like my culture, my way of life, you know, in our way, all our stories, all our really important ceremonies, all of those happen in the winter months. The really important learning happens in the winter months. And that's when I was in boarding school, being taught, you know, by the Christians. And so I always say I lost my culture. My culture was like excised out of me. The only thing I never lost is my first language. And I just attribute that to being raised by my grandma. And, because that's the only language she knew. And we spoke that with each other. That was our private language to each other's. And she always told me, you know, to not ever forget how to speak my language, to keep it. And, you know, at boarding school, whenever, me and the other kids would speak to each other in our language, we got in trouble. I got in trouble. They would stick, ivory soap in my mouth for speaking my language. But even then that didn't stop me. And I learned how to be good at being sneaky about when to speak, when it was safe to speak and when nobody could hear us. And I, at every chance I got, me and the other, kids, the next kids, we were speaking, you know, when we played, we spoke the language. So the language was never taken away from me. That's the one that I feel like maybe that was the ancestors' way of protecting. That was ancestral angels, if you will, holding me and loving me and saying, we're here. But I didn't know this because I was just so I was just so sad and so lonely for my grandma and for back home and for those baby lambs and for, you know, sleeping next to grandma. And, you know, and the other thing, when I went to boarding school, you know, my grandma and I, we ate in the traditional way. We didn't have spoons and forks and knives, you know, with the plate and everything. We ate from one pan. And you use a tortilla and you get your food with the tortilla and you eat with your hand. And then you share one cloth, which is your, you know, your cleaning cloth for your mouth. And when I first got to boarding school, you know, like we had to carry these metal trays with the forks and the knives, and I didn't know like how to do what's this, you know, and it was difficult, you know, learning how to use utensils and learning sitting at the table, all that kind of stuff. So it was just culture shock left and right, going to boarding school and then being taught, of course, about the Christianity and, you know, going to hell and what's a hell. You know, the Christians say it's a place where it burns all the time. You can't ask for ice water. And it's like, what's a ice water? Because I don't know. I came from a place where there's no refrigeration. You know, I never had an ice water before. So all these concepts that are, I don't know, you know, that are like, that I never had before, never knew before. They were saying these things to me. But over the years, I got to learn about this Christianity and this, you know, this, you know, I don't have to tell you about Christianity. Probably all of you know about Christianity or had it pushed in your throat. The main thing is, like I said, I just want to say that abandonment was the thing that was so big, like that separation, when is somebody going to remember? When is somebody going to pick me up? When is somebody going to see me? When is my family going to be here? And just that longing and melancholy and that sadness. And I learned to grow up inside that, to carry that. And like that feeling never left me for the rest of my life. I took it into my young life, into my young adulthood and into my, you know, my adult living, you know, and all the relationships that came afterwards, you know, like waiting for some recognition, waiting for acknowledgement, waiting for approval, waiting for love from the outside. Somebody's going to come from over there and put it over here. That's the main thing that abandonment, that I learned from abandonment, and that there was no, gentle, loving, supportive, sober adult to say otherwise, or to say that this is going to be over, or that I'm going to be okay, or that they care about me, or that I'm not alone, or that I'm going to be all right. All of this I carry all by myself. That's the best way I can explain abandonment. So mainly abandonment. And then of course, you know, inside of that is all the shame and all the fears, you know, like, the stories that come from being left, like, maybe something's wrong with me. Maybe the reason that my mom doesn't remember me is this, or maybe the reason that she left me is this. Maybe that, and all these stories that nobody ever said you're this, this, and that. Like, because nobody ever showed up. No human ever came in the picture to say otherwise. My psyche, my apparatus, my emotional apparatus, and just made up, and it was the worst case scenario. Like, I'm defective. I'm unlovable. I'm worthless. You know, I started to believe like I'm lower than a snake's belly. And I grew up into my life with those feelings, you know, being on the outside, never fitting in. And, you know, I went through my whole life like this, you know, and come to find out that that's the 14 survival traits of ACA. people pleasing and being afraid of authority and being afraid of conflict and, you know, staying in relationships that are very similar to where I came from, waiting for love to appear, waiting for somebody to accept me, to approve of me, all those things. So then, as I grew up, you know, I saw my mother's alcoholism getting worse and worse and worse. And eventually she died from alcoholism. And the one thing that I said to myself as I watched this woman progressing, in her alcoholism was, you know, like the shame that I felt about her, the shame that she brought to the family, the shame that she was, and wishing that I had a different mother, even though I wanted a mother. I wanted her, but I wanted her to be different. And I didn't know how that should be. I just knew that I didn't want her to be a drunken person. Time's flying by. I have to collect my thoughts. Sorry, I was really getting inside of that story. So I became an alcoholic. You know, the other character of 14 survival trait is that we either become a para-alcoholic or an alcoholic. I became alcoholic, even though I watched this woman, you know, self-destruct. I said, I'm never going to be like her. I don't ever want to be like her. I'm ashamed of her. But you know what? It was already inside of me. I think, you know, I was predisposed, you know, it was inside. And when I took my first drink of alcohol, when I was like 15, going on 16, and that booze went inside, that I took that booze inside me, even though it was the grossest thing, ugh, I swallowed it down. And once it hit my belly, you know, it exploded in that warm, hot feeling, and all the way to the bottom of my toes and the top of my head and my fingertips. And then pretty soon everything was good. And that's the feeling I fell in love with and chased, you know, from the first time I ever took a drink. I blacked out, and I love the feeling of blacking out. I love the feeling of going someplace else. I love, because I didn't have to be aware of who was looking at me, who might be paying attention to me, how I'm going to be, how I look, you know, the awkwardness, the insecurity, the not fitting in, the not having value, the being less than, the being unworthy, all of that went chopped off. And I could fit with you. I could fit with anybody. I could laugh. I could be hip, slick, and cool. I could be smart. I could be articulate. I could be funny. I could be anything. And I loved it. And I forgot that I said, I don't want to be like my mama. The unfortunate thing is that I didn't really have any control over that, you know, and just like I didn't have any control over my mama, I didn't have any control over the booze that went in my body. And, you know, the booze took me and I became an alcoholic. And, but thank goodness, you know, I got the gift of sobriety, in, 1990, I was given the gift of sobriety. I came in through, an institution, you know, cause I used to think, oh, I showed up at AA, all AA doors all by myself, you know, but I took some time to look at that. And I was like, you know, like, cause some people say they came by the nudge of a judge, or through, you know, some other circumstance. And I was happy that, you know, I never went to jail. It wasn't from the judge. And then I was happy, you know, that those things was true. And then I, after like getting some more honesty, because these programs are all about, you know, little by slowly honesty creeps in, you know, even though I'm trying to deny. And honesty came in and I was like, oh, somebody from another place said that I should go to AA. That's how I came in. Actually, I went to the Al-Anon meeting first and then AA. But I want to tell you that, you know, I spent like the first, I don't know, almost 10 years of in the AA rooms, not happy I'm sober, you know, but just kind of just like, it was like a place of rest, you know, go to get a cup of coffee and just some place to like, you know, cause I was always tapping my toes and, you know, I was nervous and, you know, my heart was always pounding and I was always scared. And, you know, like I was always like looking like this over my shoulder and I never looked at people in the eyes. I was looking down. You know, like always looking at the watch, smoking lots of cigarettes. And, like I couldn't settle down. It was this nervous energy. And I come to learn that that's survival. I was just surviving in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And after a while, I heard I heard the same thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. I came in a time when it was all white men with white hair sitting around the tables. I didn't realize that at first. It took some time to recognize this. Like it dawned on me, came into focus and it's like, whoa, white men with white hair. And then the next thing I realized, they're saying the same thing. I lost my house. I lost my dog. I lost my car. I lost my job. And I was like, none of those things happened to me. What the heck am I doing in here? You know, and little by slowly, you know, different things happened that I was able to like, I was going to get ready to leave and something happened. And like I turned again, you know, how they say, don't leave before the miracle happens. And it was always like that was happening. Another turn and then another turn. And to the finally where a woman came in my life, that helped me, you know, through my first set of steps.
That's 5 minutes left.
Oh my goodness. And then thank you very much. And then after doing the steps, you know, like I was able to like get more honesty. And it wasn't until 2012, that I, well, I heard about ACA before, way before I got sober. But I didn't stay in ACA because it was just, there was too much crying in there. I couldn't handle the crying. I had to go drink. But in 2012, I got passed up for a promotion. My boss gave me this raving review. I stayed in the same career because of my sobriety. I think I stayed in the same career for 25 years. And in 2012, you know, I was up for a promotion and everybody on this panel told me, you're this and that. And I was just, they made me a big star. And then my big boss said, the reason why I'm not going to give you this promotion is because your English is not good. And then that was all. And then, you know, that was like so traumatic for me. You know, my trauma response, you know, is like, I don't get it until a while later. Like I can't respond. If somebody says, do you want to say something about that? I can't like the cat got my tongue, right? I can't speak. I don't know what to say. Like that thing that they say in the red book, the eyes, your pupils dilate. You hear a boom, boom, the blood pumping in your ears and your heart pounds and you can't speak. That's what happened to me when she said that. And I just got filled with a rage, you know, like I was homicidal and suicidal and like, you know, like what? Like my English isn't good, you know? And the whole time in my mind, I was saying these words, fuck you, exclamation point. Isn't that like the perfect English? Fuck you, exclamation point. that's a good English, right? That's a perfect English. Why? But I didn't say it out loud. I was too scared to say it out loud. And I was going crazy, and, you know, I was ready to, you know, drink or whatever. And my sponsor, my AA sponsor at the time said, honey, this doesn't sound like you. It sounds like little Karen is injured. And I was like, what? And she says, and she was so sweet, you know, this sponsor. And she said, I'm concerned for you. She said it like that, you know, so she said, maybe you can go talk to a therapist. You know, this sounds different. And I went to a therapist, and the very first therapist I went to, I told him this story, you know, and then she reached up in her bookshelf and she brought the yellow book. I didn't know it was the yellow book of AC. She brought it and she said, let me read you something. She read me the 14 character traits, all of them. And I was sitting there. I was like rocking like this. And I was mad. I was like, not another goddamn fucking 12-step program like that. And she said, this is ACA. And I think that this is like for you. I was like, no. But slowly I started going. And in 2012, I started going to meetings. 1 minute. Okay. I started slowly going to meetings. I'm so sorry. I got so caught up in all those stories. But yeah. And, you know, like fast forward, it's the ACA that really is like, to me, I call it the PhD of all the 12-step programs, because that's the one that made me go deep into the bottom of my belly and dig up in 2020, you know, the grandma Corona, she threw me on the ground with my face into the carpet and made me cry. All the historical pain that I carried, the shame, you know, that I can't look people in the eye, that I'm a dirty Indian, that I'm disgusting, that I'm good for nothing. You know, even after, you know, 20 plus something years of sobriety, I still believe that ugly shit. And it wasn't until Grandma Corona throwing me on the ground and making me cry and cry all that ugly stuff out, vomit it out. And, you know, and for 1 year, 2020 and 2021, through ACA, with my fellow traveler, and then being introduced to the Turtle Island ACA. I mean, like, that's the stuff that like helped me like clear out. And now in 2022, like for the first time in my life, I can hear like the ancestral voices. I can hear the I can hear like the ancestors telling me, we love you. We are here for you. Don't forget us. Please don't leave us. They say the same thing that I said. Please, is somebody going to see me? Is somebody going to love me? The ancestors say the same thing. And I get to like pray to the ancestors and connect. And, you know, I live in a place where there's like trails that I hike all these years. I lived here. And now every day I go out like yesterday and there's a little bit of snow on the ground. I saw ancestral objects and pieces on the ground, almost like somebody just put them there. And to me, that's the ancestors' sign saying, we love you, child. We love you, baby. We carry you. We don't forget you. Please don't forget us. And that's like the healing of ACA. And I can't say enough for ACA. And like I said, I'm sorry, I got stuck in the old stories. But ACA is definitely like the medicine, the structure of the medicine. And I'm so grateful that today I can say I have that ancestral healing and ancestral energy that just picks me up, and I get to stand towards them and heal them, and I've been healed, and I get to heal them. Blow loving energy, pray loving energy, talk loving energy to the source of the ancestors today, and that's all because of ACA. And I'm so grateful for this, and thank you for letting me share. And peace.